welcome to the Classic Cult TV Club. Today we're looking at The Young Ones. So that's a bit of a divergence from our normal fare, at least recently. I guess our first episode was The Goodies, wasn't it? This is where we started and we're heading back.
Early 80s compared to 70s.
Okay, yeah. So we're heading just a little bit later. And this one's from 1982 to 1984, starring Adrian Edmondson, Rick Mayall, Nigel Planer, Christopher Ryan, Alex Sale.
Alexei Sale.
So that was broadcast for 2 years. And we're here with Lisa.
Hi.
Alex.
Hey.
Angus.
Hello.
Gypsy.
Hey.
And Jeanette.
Hi.
And I'm Justin. I guess, you know, we're sort of in an age group where a lot of us have seen it and some of us haven't, but, you know, who has and who hasn't seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. I actually bought the episodes today because I was planning for it.
This was Alex's choice.
Yes, because a lot of the stuff I watch is 21st century and therefore outside the scope of this show. So I'm like, hey, this is old enough and it works enough for the style of the show. So yeah, I'll bring it along.
Angus, have you seen?
Yes, it was about 5 years ago, I think. But yeah, I watched through it all basically through year 12.
There's only about all up. 12. I think there's how many episodes?
12. 12, 12, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not many episodes to watch. Yeah,
They're pretty good short.
Yeah.
Is it really a sitcom? Because it's kind of a weird mix between sitcom and sketch.
Yeah, it's sort of halfway in between, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Gypsy, have you seen Young Ones before?
Yeah, like over 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Not over 10 years. I was 12 at the time.
Wow.
And I didn't enjoy it.
Oh. What made you not enjoy it?
The fact that it's targeted to young adults.
Oh, okay.
At 12 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, it went way over my head. Red Dwarf was so much better.
Oh, yeah. You're a Das Kapital fan, and I think this is very much
I watched that when I was 18.
Because I think it's not just the fact that it's like Das Kapital, it's the fact that it's all over the shop. It does every single kind of humour, basically.
Mm.
So
I understand that it's like grunge and pushing the barriers and stuff. I just...
Don't remember it
and didn't care for it.
Yeah.
I think the first time I ever saw it, I had mixed feelings, but it grew on me. I think it takes comedy a little while to grow on you, and in my case, it took just a few episodes and then I was in.
My parents had a copy of Spitting Image, which was an English puppet type show.
It was satirical.
And, satirical puppets. It's a bit of a hard one. But and then afterwards, they had the horror episode of The Young Ones. And so up until probably mid-90s, that was the only episode that I'd seen. And I knew it backwards and forwards and inside and out. And
have you got a video?
Have you got a video? Yes, we've got a video! I could quote that inside out, backwards and forwards when I was a kid. And so then, in the late 90s, I finally watched the whole thing and then bought the DVDs back in late 90s, early 2000s.
And Jeanette, as a frequent cooker of lentils...
well, funnily enough, I was working as a cook when I first saw it. That was when I was up in the Gulf.
Did it inspire you? Or?
No. I didn't know what a lentil was then. Okay. Long before my lentil cooking days.
Okay, so I guess we'll get on with it. We'll have a look, and this is season 1, episode 2, and it's called Oil. So I guess we'll find out what it's like.
See young ones, darling, we're the young ones.
Okay, so that was The Young Ones. Pretty anarchic. So, Gypsy, what did you think of that after previous dislike?
Or... casually say that I'm ambivalent.
Still ambivalent.
But at least that's a step up from despising it.
Yeah.
I didn't despise it. I literally didn't care for it the first time I saw it, and I don't feel like my life has been changed since watching it.
I've got to ask, though, what's the difference between that and Das Kapital?
Very similar in some...
Very similar.
It really is. It factually is, but the difference is then doesn't have Paul McDermott.
I was meant to say Paul McDermott.
Paul McDermott.
We could have exported him over maybe for a few episodes. I'm not sure how he would have fared.
Yeah, I think
it does have Hagrid, though.
I think the bigger part of it all was it solidifies my love for Doc Martens, but that's about it.
I like that song. Said man,
actually,
on the
like
way.
That song.
I don't know why. We used to just sing it. We used to sing it a lot when I got the DVDs, and it's just I think because it's just so odd.
Yeah, I think as well because it's probably the only episode where the musical accompanist is that weird. Because normally it's just the band coming in and playing their song.
Yeah.
Or is that? I didn't even think that it was actually the song by the band actually having written the song. I think it was just Lexi Sales like, okay, I want to do this thing where I make a joke about capitalism somehow.
Well, I think he had an album out around this time too, didn't he? I don't know whether it was a comedy album or whether it was a serious album. Yeah. But
Alexei Sayle serious? I don't think so. Yeah, he's very out there, isn't he?
Yeah.
They're all very out there, of course. Yeah.
And so I guess the Young Ones had the Comedy Aid single, the version of Cliff Richard's Living Doll, but then Neil had his own concept album, which I had on tape when I was a kid. Did all of those psychedelic kind of 60s songs like Hole in My Shoe and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. The one I remember was Madness playing. That was
Madness played twice. They played Our House in the episode of the second season, and they played Welcome to House of Fun in the third episode.
Oh,
of the
that's first right, season. Yes.
Yeah, music clips make a lot more sense now.
Yeah.
Madness, that is.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why they had the musical interludes in the episodes, I remember reading something years ago where they found out they could just do a regular sitcom, comedy sitcom, but if they had entertainment in it, it went into a different category with a better budget.
Yeah. So they could do the weird sketch things, like having the scenes with puppets as like a few of them each episode, and like that would be probably be stretching the budget if they wanted to do it every single episode, but they had extra funding because
they
had
the fact that they blow up half their set every episode.
It is interesting that the formula for most of the comedy that we've watched so far, though, is sitcom and then song in the middle.
If
you've noticed, like The Monkees, The Goodies, Das Kapital.
Goodies used to have their little songs, didn't they?
So it was always like a song themed around the episode.
I was going to say that was exactly like The Monkees. Yeah.
That was not at all like The Monkees.
Oh, I've got it wrong again.
The Monkees did come first, so it's a similar, more of a punk take on it. Yeah.
Yet again, it's the guys in somehow grouped together and
it's like that odd couple. That odd couple, but in that same way that Red Dwarf kind of has that appeal, none of the main characters have any appeal whatsoever. They're just horrible human beings, and I think
I like
that part of it.
Yeah, I was it out. It's Rick the character. Rick's the character you want to punch in the face. And Vivian's the character you don't want to punch in the face because he'll punch you in the face back. Mike, you don't want to punch in the face because he'll pay you not to do so. And Neil will punch himself in the face. So, yeah, it's like the characters you hate but you enjoy seeing on the screen.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be all horrible, which is a really good formula for most comedy.
Yeah.
Not entirely horrible. I mean, you feel a little bit sorry for Neil, I suppose.
A bit.
You can't hate him. He's pathetic. Yeah. He's just very pathetic. And in Red Dwarf, you don't actually hate Lister. He's not dislikable. No. There's times you just go,
But they're just really that anti-hero like.
Yeah, he's very much the anti-hero. Yeah. And they're all anti-heroes.
I feel like I like Lister more than I like Neil, though.
Yeah.
Lister has
character in one. Yes, they're all very much stereotypes. Mm. They're the stereotypical
it's one way
hippie, it's they're the push. Stereotypical
they're much more shallow.
The
straight guy though was clearly stolen from Graham from The Goodies. So obvious.
He was supposed to is that Mike?
Oh. Yeah,
Mike. Yeah, he's supposed to be kind of like this shyster con artist kind of guy, isn't he? Like a mobster or
it's
something.
It's more like a megalomaniac. It's like 1 minute, we're going to search for gold. The next minute, I have a roller disco here. So Graham.
It was a little bit like Graham and the pirate thing where suddenly I'm going to be a millionaire and
which is our first episode of course.
Radio Goodies.
Or the gunfight at the OKT room where Graham's like, there's scones in them there hills.
Yes,
I'm going to be rich now.
I think in this one he's more of a bit of a shyster underworld figure.
Graham occasionally is
sort of the underworld, but he's more the intellectual computer expert.
But he's always the megalomaniac that does the weirdest of things.
What did people think about, you know, the acting and how well it sort of stands up to modern comedy?
I like seeing something like the rapport between Rick and Vivian. Yeah, Adrian Edmondson and Rick Mayall. Mm-hmm. And seeing how that then evolves with other collaborations like Bottom, where it was pretty much them just smacking the gack out of each other for half an hour. And this is where it all starts. I think they were doing that kind of slapstick.
Yeah, it's very slapstick, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, can it be slapstick when they're just belting the living daylights out of each other? I'm not sure.
The point of slapstick is like you just act violently. It's like funny just to see him just like, aha, you missed both my legs.
Yeah. They'd been working together for a long time before The Young Ones, I think, and then they kept carrying on and working together.
It's obviously a good rapport between the actors just to carry off what they do.
Yeah. And this show was really, it was a starting base for a lot of really well-known comedians and comedy actors. We saw Robbie Coltrane in this episode, but geez, you know, once you get started, I mean, oh my goodness, French Imogen Saunders, Helen Pace, Emma Thompson, Fry and Laurie, Smith and Jones. Like, you think of all of the different actors that kind of started with tiny little cameos. Yeah. Mm. Chris Barry was in an episode of The Young Ones. Like, just, yeah, there's so many different cameos. There's also many cameos of actors that didn't go on and do big things as well. But the amount that did actually, this was kind of a launch pad for them. Whether it's their first moment on television, I'm not sure. But I know the episode, the one where they're on the game show and it's got
University Challenge. Yeah, where it's like, where it's Ben Elton, Emma Thompson, Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry as the, was it Footlights College, Oxbridge?
Footlights. They all met and were friends from that.
And so Ben Elton was one of the creators of The Young Ones. And then, you've got Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie as the other contestants. Yeah. And then, they were all assholes
just to be foils for the other team.
But they all kind of started off, I think, their team was called Oxbridge or something because they were, when this was one of their first TV acting roles. So, you think of people of that calibre and this is where they started up.
Mm. But in terms of standing on its own feet, I feel like it definitely, compared to modern comedy, like compare that to something like Big Bang Theory and Good Lord.
Yeah.
You can put that on TV and I feel like there'd be a couple of people going, that's a silly, because the bottom joke, I've got a runny bottom. It's very outdated because it was crass at the time. And
lowbrow.
Yeah, it was very lowbrow.
The whole joke about Rick wanting to have a bit of a concert to help Neil be the masses overthrown or whatever, that would have made sense in the political comedy at the time, but it doesn't really work today when we're so not as communist-y. So it probably would have been really radical for the time there, but now it just seems dated.
And also hippies, you don't really have hippies.
I've never heard of punks.
And I think that's because it's early 80s, wearing flares and being a hippie is so 70s. He's out of date,
He was anachronistic.
Yeah. What even was the things in Vivian's head? They just had on the forehead, the studs.
And he had the ring through his nose and stuff like that, which would have been...
But that's kind of stuff we don't really see anymore. It's just been normalised to the point where it's like, sometimes people do weird stuff with their hair, but not really anymore.
I don't think it was ever as big in Australia as it was in Britain.
Well, actually, interesting thought on that. Fun fact. In the 80s, it was the start of, you know how everybody stereotypes people into goth, punk, that sort of thing? That's where it all started. So it used to be marketed as at like normal girls and boys, and then it became, oh shit, we need to market to this stereotype and this stereotype, and that's where it all started. So goth, emo, that sort of thing, that's literally just a generational thing.
Yeah.
So companies could sell their products better to...
That's where it all started. That's how the
Sex Pistols started. It was like Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood had their store where they were selling all of their punk clothes, but they needed a way to get it out to the masses, so they created the Sex Pistols. They were a manufactured band, so they could sell their punk products. They're about as real as the Spice Girls, man. They were completely manufactured. And it was all about the branding, and that's why, Johnny Lydon went on and did Public Image Limited, in the 80s, the new wave stuff, because that was the stuff he actually wanted to do. He didn't want to do the Sex Pistols punk stuff. So it was just a branding. It was commercialization.
Yeah, literally all of how to be marketed at, and people are toning it down because the masses are so nullified nowadays that you don't need, the punks, not that you don't need them, it's just that they aren't there because we've all been there's nothing that you need to rebel against, it's all good.
Alternatively,
that's one thing I do like about The Young Ones, is stuff to push back.
I think it's also as well, rebellion's been so commodified. I'm just thinking, in the 90s when grunge and alternative whatever was popular, Coca-Cola actually had a brand called OK and it was based on that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's the point where you can't really rebel against anything because you'll get into an ad in 6 months later.
Having Che Guevara's face on designer label clothing.
Didn't they try to do that with Pepsi and was it Kendall Jenner? That kind of backfired.
It's called associative marketing, where you basically try and take something and associate it with a lifestyle. It divides the market so you can actually sell the same thing that looks slightly different to different people
and associate
it with that lifestyle.
Yeah, alternatively, you make an ad featuring some controversial figure and people are talking about the ad, therefore it's advertising in the product. The downside is you can't rebel against anything anymore because now brands are just copying everything.
Back to Young Ones. But if we were to compare it to a show that would be around today in that same similar vein, I don't know if any of you guys have watched It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
To me, it's got
that same type of feel where it is quite lowbrow and all of the main characters are just complete dirtbags in one way or the other, all completely different odd couple kind of group. At least these guys, they're kind of a little bit more endearing than the people from It's Always Sunny. They're just horrendous people. But it's that same type of thing where you just take different types of odd couples, but not in a way that they all blend together in a lovely little Brady Bunch way, or the Monkees or something where they all just get along. They all just really just bring each other down to a really dark place.
And I think also as well, one thing I like about It's Always Sunny is the satire works because you're hating all of them and therefore they're the assholes. It's like the same way that you're not supposed to empathize with Ricky because he's supposed to be opposed to trying to be political, but he's failing at it. In the same way, any time that the gang in Philadelphia try to do anything, they're horrible at it and you're supposed to hate them for it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I know seeing an interesting theme that we're not talking about the episode itself, we're talking about its relevance, and that's probably a weird thing. It's like we're saying, oh, it's inspired this, it's based on this, it's similar to this, and we're not actually talking about the show itself.
But that's the thing, the show is in itself such a cult classic that so many things have been based off.
There's a lot of social satire in it.
There's a lot of
social commentary, social satire, and some of it has still got relevance today. We talked about communism being not a joke, but the fascism references are very much current. Unfortunately,
different style of fascism.
It's like Rick calling Neil a fascist just because he was wanting to go to bed and being a
term that was bandied about as a comedy term at the time, but there are still elements of, especially Mike, you know, we're going to make oil, there is social commentary in there. I did make a note about the upstairs downstairs of the
I love that
little bit, especially with Downton Abbey, with the servants that worship the masters, and they're so happy to be servants and serve them,
and I think that was
captured really well with the mop and the broom.
And I always knew that it was an upstairs downstairs reference, but it wasn't until I watched Downton Abbey that now I actually got it a lot better than I did when I watched it when I was a kid.
Yeah, because there's probably stuff in there that, like, a few pop culture references that make sense at the time, but nothing otherwise. But then again, most comedies like that.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a lot of the comedy will date. And I think comedy dates more than drama.
I remember seeing somebody make a comment that in order to be comedic, you have to be visual enough that it has to be transgressive enough that's funny, but not so transgressive that it starts being offensive. Mm. And you have to straddle that line. And so it ages worse because either we've evolved past that, or the stuff that is transgressive then doesn't make sense anymore, and stuff like that. And so it ages worse than anything else.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Because I think certain sitcoms probably age better than this kind of more situational satire comedy.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I think I only watched two episodes, and in reality, wasn't a massive fan. And to sit down and watch it, I'm like, now especially, I'm like, I'm that out of the loop of whatever happened at that point in time that I've got to say that
when you talk about aging comedy, there's a lot worse. I mean, this has aged a little bit, and it's still watchable, but it's aged quite a lot, and there's a lot of references that people won't get. But if you look at comedy of the period, like, say, The Two Ronnies, Porridge.
They talk about The Good Life in episodes of this.
The Good Life is still worse.
There
is so much that is just awful to watch now. What was it, Benny Hill? Those things just do not translate at all. I'm not sure we really want to go there, actually, but this is in the mid-ground, I think,
but
of stuff that's
translated.
Yeah, they're not sitcoms, but they are comedy shows. Yeah.
And in a way, when this show was first brought out, you guys were the key demographic. Mm. So, in a way, you know, that same age, the early 20s, late teens.
We were the key demographic. I wasn't born. What age?
Yeah. No, exactly. Well, late teens, early 20s. Yeah. You know, your age now would have been that key demographic they would have been looking for.
And what's the thing as well, like, say, the vignettes and just like random jokes here and there, some of them being like the few jokes in there that were, what, back in the 4-4, or like the bit, which is basically a skit. Because I'm living on the internet and I've seen a lot of compilations of old Vines, that feels slow to me, even though it was probably really, really quick and witty. Mm. Back then, it's like the internet's gotten so much faster that it felt as though it was dragging through some bits, even though it was probably running through the jokes and referencing a lot at the time.
We're also much more used to the breaking of the fourth wall now. Back then, it was quite radical. So when I first saw this, I thought it was, and I was probably 22, 23 when I first saw it. I thought it was hilarious. And partly because it did all those things that normal comedy didn't do.
But now we do it all the time to the point where this is normal. This is almost bland.
Well, that's a generic problem with the cult TV club. The classic cult TV club. We're always going to be looking at things where someone has followed it up and used what we've seen. It's whether you can go back, that's the question.
I think some of these skittish bits in there work if you treat them as skits and they're fun in it by itself. But I think it's the idea of, like, this is transgressive. This is so... It doesn't work anymore because we're transgressive farther than that. And that's what always happens. That's just what I always say at every comedy show. I just say, we've gone past that. Yeah.
You asked about the acting, and I know we covered two people, but I really factually hated the acting.
The acting, it was
like a bit where one of the guys was going to hit another or something like that. There was like a sequence, and just watching like the and then the ow afterwards, like with that gap, I was just like, oh my god, really? That's it felt like it was really, really put on.
Yeah.
I don't know. It felt super put on and very, you know, when someone puts on a really fake smile and you can feel it and you're like, okay, cool. And then you just don't believe it. It can pull you away from that person. That's kind of what it felt like, is someone was smiling at me and being as fake as possible, and that made me go, this bit's not doing it for me.
Sure.
Really not doing it.
These guys were plucked straight from the comedy club, and even Ben Elton, who created it, I think they'd all come straight from the comedy club.
They plucked them from the drama club.
Exactly. I was thinking that. They should have probably put them in some acting classes before they actually put them on the TV.
And then Red Dwarf, most of those were not professional actors either. No. Chris Bowie, I think, was the only actual professional actor.
And he was an impersonator. He wasn't like an actor.
Yeah. And I think that's what the acting looked like, is just keep pushing.
Whereas Descafadella is very flow.
Yeah, it felt very flow. But it was at the very end of their career as well. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, they had performed in Edinburgh. They started off in Canberra on the steps. Finally, at the end, after doing Jesus Christ Superstar, they went, let's make a really dumb TV show.
And they've been doing Big Gig for years as well.
So they had that interlocked thing. So when stuff happened, they just went, yes, if Paul's going to hit me in the face, I'll do this.
Whereas these guys are just beginning, really.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the general consensus, what do people think? Is it worth going back to? Is it a history lesson? Or has it got value in its own right?
I'm just realising, when I watched this back to find which episode we should watch, I was watching it at double speed just to see what it was like, and I think that's probably the best way to watch it.
Double speed, yeah.
It's an interesting ride just because of the way the comedy works. It's like everything all at once, but it's interesting to see what it was like back then, even though it's not transgressive anymore. If you wanted to get a satire, you could get better satire today, and so on. So I think it's an interesting thing to watch, but not necessarily, like, I would watch it in my own time and be enjoying the whole thing.
But you have watched the entire series.
It's just like some of the other episodes. I thought this would be the best episode of the bunch, because you have ones that kind of, say, dwell on one joke or dwell on the sitcom-y bit of it so much that it ends up not being as fun to watch.
I think if you're going to introduce someone to it, though, go with the episode with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and stuff, because I was more interested in watching that, just by the sound of it.
Yeah, well,
because you had well-known people in it.
You did. Is that their roles are more cameos than anything else?
But that's what'll draw people in. That's a big thing for people
to see where people begin.
Exactly.
People go in to watch the final episode of season two without watching anything.
So educational, you think? Go back, see where these people began.
Yeah, definitely.
And also reminded me on how hot Dawn French was back in the day.
I think it'd be good to go back and watch it to understand why old people are the way they are.
So you think you might understand us better by watching?
I don't think I could ever understand you better.
Rick or Vivian, which are you?
I'm probably more Neil. Neil.
I was a huge fan of Neil when I was a kid, but then when I went back and watched it as an adult, I'm probably more Team Rick. I don't know why. Probably the same reason I'm Team Rimmer. I like it.
Yeah.
Talk to a therapist about that one.
Oh, no, definitely Vivian. Vivian for me.
If I was younger, Vivian. If I was older, it's the mob boss.
Mike.
Definitely. Okay. I am older, sorry, not if.
And you will be older even later.
Okay, so that was
just the Young Ones.
That was the Young Ones. Okay, so it's goodbye from Classic Cult TV Club.
Yeah.
See ya.
Bye. See ya.